You are listening to Healing Natural Wellness Podcast, episode number 18. Today, we're talking about creating intimate relationships with self-clarity, vulnerability, and best tips for a fulfilling relationship. Hey loves, Astrid here. Welcome to Healing Natural Wellness Podcast. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for tuning in. The Healing Natural Wellness Podcast is produced twice a month for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at www.healyounaturally.com/podcasts. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitches, Google, Alexa Play, and all major podcast directories. You can also follow me on Twitter at @heal_naturally and on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at @healyounaturally. All links are in the show notes. Now let's get into the show. Hey everyone, today I have a great guest. His name is Marcus Lin, a relationship coach and future psychologist, also known as the Realist Therapist. Today we're going to be talking about creating intimate relationships with self-clarity, vulnerability, and best tips for a fulfilling relationship. Marcus, welcome to the Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Privileged to be here.
Absolutely. I'm so excited about our topic today. And as usual, we're going to jump right in. I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about Marcus first. Marcus attends the University of Calgary as a psychology student, and he's also a relationship coach. Marcus is someone who has taken his own family dysfunctions and traumas and through spirituality, attending ministry school, doing lots of self-help research to successfully possess a healthy and fulfilling community. He published his first article on Medium in 2017, reaching over 10,000 readers. He has now emotionally overcome and rebuilt his life and relationships. He's passionate about educating others on the topics of intimacy, communication, and healthy relationship practices, and focuses on both romantic and platonic relationships alike. So we're going to jump right in, Marcus. Briefly tell us about your journey into relationship coaching, becoming a psychology student and as a future psychologist.
Yeah. So my passion and my desire to get into this space actually came from when I was a kid, and actually what I didn't have growing up in a family, feeling relatively isolated, feeling quite alone, all that kind of thing, just kind of got a knack and an understanding for the importance of relationships. And so through, obviously, the dysfunction of my family, I just kind of like started learning. Really, I was an observer of my family, eventually really began diving into spirituality, went out to ministry school, and then eventually switched over to psychology to take a more secular, holistic route for everyone instead of just those who are, you know, more involved in the church. So yeah, and then I just got more and more specialized and kind of got into the self-help field and really just learned as much as I could, and eventually just started sharing my knowledge and educating other people with my own process of training as well.
Excellent. I just found you as you know, on Instagram, and I actually found your posts fascinating because they're refreshing. You know, I love your approach when it comes to relationships. So we're going to be talking about this, guys, because relationships today, which Marcus and I were discussing a couple of days ago, in terms of how difficult dating is today and relationships, but he also has a really good approach in terms of kind of like going back to basics and things like that. But we'll talk about that later. So, Marcus, why don't you tell me about the self-concept clarity and how we should approach posting information about ourselves? You have a post like that on Instagram that really caught my attention. So I want you to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So self-concept clarity is a huge backbone of how I approach relationships and how I even really approach life, honestly. So self-concept clarity really explains and states that we as people, we like to feel and understand why we are or who we are. And so this gets into that whole cheesy saying that your beliefs can change the world. And in retrospect, you know, of course they can. But there's, instead of, it's not just a spiritual law of attraction invisible kind of thing. It's very scientific. It's very practical, very tactical as well in the scientific field. There's a theory of the self-clarification that states that we like having clarity about ourselves. It's how we come to grips with what's around us. When we receive when we receive information contrary to what we know about ourselves, depending on who it's coming from, we're likely to just ignore it. So an example being, if you have an article and you're just writing, it's your first time writing, and maybe an acquaintance, someone you don't really know, but someone you know of, says that you're a good writer, but you think you're not a good writer, you likely will actually totally throw out their compliment because it goes against what you think and what you feel and what you know yourself. And so this is where self-clarity is so important, because you navigate the world around you based on who you are. And it's operating from a real strong inside out mentality. And I realize that for myself, for other people, and for a lot of people that I see, people don't exactly have the clearest sense of self. They don't understand themselves well enough to operate in the world around them. And it can get really messy and really, really dirty really fast.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. Excellent. So I just wanted to read a little bit of your post excerpt that I found really fascinating. We as people are psychologically wired and compelled to feel as though we understand who we are. If someone compliments you in a way that you don't feel is true or valid, we'll discard that comment as a lie because it runs contrary to what we know, hold true, and rely on as we navigate life in ourselves, which you already talked about. Of course, the issue is that we can begin denying good things at one stage in life because we internalize a different reality at a previous stage. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. And so this is huge. And this is a big lesson that I've experienced in my life, is what you use to protect yourself, what you use to strengthen yourself in one season and at one time in your life can very much become a liability in a later stage of life. A good example for me was independence. A lot of people, when you come from a hard background, you are forced to be independent. You're the strong one. You're the reliable one. You need to have the answers. If you don't have the answers, bad things happen. When you're in a dangerous environment, a bad family, a bad relationship, that's needed. That's expected. But when you're actually in a loving relationship where someone's empathetically caring about you, asking how you're doing, and is actually giving you space to be flawed, you actually remove yourself from being loved in a lot of very intimate places, because you won't actually present something that you feel is quote unquote unfinished in yourself, which means if you're literally not allowing yourself to grow with somebody. So yeah, I mean, when you go through life, we're always changing, of course. And so as you adapt, as you grow, it's important to relate the inner you to the outward you and really grow together. You're always changing, you're always shifting, but making sure you're shifting with your environment and actively choosing to let go of the things you don't need anymore.
Fascinating. You're making really good points here. So we're going to jump to the next question. And this is something that it's pretty relevant to my audience and your audience, because a lot of them are females. I don't know if you would agree with that. So I wanted to deviating for a little bit of that topic. I saw one of your posts where it said, it read, is he not being vulnerable? So that is something that I realize a lot of relationship coaches talk about when it comes to men, because some men have a lot of trouble in being vulnerable and opening up and things like that because of society, the way the social norm, right? So why don't you tell us a little bit about that post in terms of when men aren't vulnerable, is that because society norms, is that because it's wired within them? Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? And basically, how can we women potentially help our better halves to become more vulnerable and so on?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, this is definitely I'm a rarity as a male in the therapist field. It is a very female dominated arena. And I like giving this perspective because it's not something that's talked about as much. I love the feministic perspective. I love that female equalities, becoming front and center. But obviously, I do have a soft spot for males to have a place to be vulnerable. And right now, you know, in society and by expectation, there's a big lie among men that they feel the need to have the answers, that their value and their worth is directly tied to the value that they bring to the table. It's a lie that I've believed. It's a lie, you know, that I've held on to, that I think I'm only as good as what I can do for other people, which negates any innate sense of self and personhood, and obviously creates such a barrier to intimacy. And so as men, you know, if you want us to be vulnerable, there has to be an environment for it. And the ironic thing is that it can't look like what women do, because we're still not women. It still has to look and be fashioned in a way where it's permissible for a man to be a man in vulnerability. And so for a lot of guys, it's like, we don't want to cry. We don't want to break down. We don't want to, you know, feel like that. A lot of men don't feel connected by weeping in someone's arms. I don't want to say it's not how we're wired, but typically that's not what connection looks like for us. And so if you want a man to be vulnerable, it's a lot about creating that environment that is complementary and allows men to be vulnerable, but still doesn't negate his manhood. And so I looking at it like bro time, guys can be vulnerable with other guys because it's bro time. There's no weakness involved. It's we're bros. I'm going through some shit. I don't know if I can cuss. Sorry.
Sorry. It's okay. That's fine.
Yeah, I'm going through things and, you know, that's it. We're handling it, but I am free to show weakness. On a scale from, let's say, -5 to 5, you know, -5 being like that crying, weepy kind of thing, and then, you know, 5 being like that armor protective. It's like, men don't like to get into the negatives. We want to stay at 0. And that's what vulnerability looks like for a lot of guys, is let's stay at 0. I have a problem, but it's actually okay. So if you want a man to be vulnerable, it looks like creating that place by not actually diminishing his manhood and devaluing him by not having answers. Like, if you really want to get a guy to wall up, ask him, what are you going to do about it? Or, you know, like, just push him to action, because that's what he's always led to do. But vulnerability is a state of being, and you have to let him be. And so creating an environment where he's rewarded for vulnerability, where it's considered sexy, where he can get affirmations, that's that environment where vulnerability for a man is conducive. And that's difficult to create. And it's something I think a lot of people, society, and couples need to work on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know, like, I keep seeing recently, like, you know, or maybe it's always been, but I just read about it more as of right now. It's like the feminine energy and the masculine energy. You know, I believe that it's important to let men do, you know, have that energy and not try to be like, again, you know, I'm a strong woman, I'm a mom, I've done everything. But I do believe that it's important to let men get in that space. You know, it allows you to grow as a male, you know, in the relationship. And I think that's also one of the, also, like, I actually learned that with my own experience. You know, when I was younger or single, I used to be like, you know, if I asked something, I've always been the type of person that I handle the truth better than lies. I could take the truth better than if I find out that you're lying, you know. But going back to that, I would be a lot more. I was very strict when it came to, like, if I'm asking something and he told me, my reaction would be like, oh, what do you mean? You know, and get all, like, you know, all messed up. But then as you grow, as you mature per se, now I'm like, all right, I'm going to listen to, you know, if I'm asking you for the truth, learn how to handle that truth, right?
Yeah.
It's easier said than done, but also, like, being a little bit more cautious in terms of, like, how you react to when a man is telling you, right? What do you think about
that? Yes. Oh my gosh. Absolutely. And so that gets into a major, major point that we haven't actually discussed, but when you're talking about relationships and vulnerability and connecting, there's a major difference between vulnerability and feedback. Feedback is for you. Vulnerability is for the person speaking. And so if you want a man to be vulnerable, he's going to be talking about himself. And the thing with relationships is when somebody's blowing up, they might be saying, you know, F you, F this, whatever, whatever. But that, you can take it as feedback. More than likely, they're blowing up because something vulnerable, something inside them is being violated. vulnerability can always be feedback, or excuse me, let me say this. Feedback is always vulnerability, but vulnerability isn't always feedback. Vulnerability is where the person speaking benefit, but feedback, even when it's stated, can still come from a vulnerable place because it comes from pain, it comes from hurt, it comes from, you know, not getting our needs and all these different things. And so, yes, if a woman is looking and trying to create an environment for her man to be vulnerable, you know, encourage him to talk about himself, you know, the situation. It's not about who's, and like rid all aspects of blame or right and wrong. It's not about that. Vulnerability is about my experience. What am I feeling? And you can steer the conversation that way. But if he does, you know, maybe give a point of feedback about you or about someone you know or anything like that, understand he's talking about his experience. That's still vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. That is fantastic. Guys, we're learning so much about relationships. This is a very important topic. Again, allowing the other person to be vulnerable, to listen and not get, you know, angry while there's a disagreement. It's so important to keep you cool. And yeah, easier said than done if we ask my better half mm-hmm. about keeping cool for the most part.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So we're going to move to the next question. Thank you so much for answering that. So another one of your really good posts that caught my attention is, in relationships, are you hearing what they mean or only listening to what they're saying? Why don't you talk about that? You know, I think that's really important. And like I said, it's easier said than done, but tell us about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so absolutely. So the reason it's easier said than done, I'll get into that, is like when you look at the brain, there's different areas of the brain. You know, we all heard of the fight or flight response. You know, it's the animalistic reaction. What happens in that state is, you know, we do get amped to run or amped to fight. Our creativity, our logic, our reasoning, our empathy plummet. And in that place, it's very difficult to have an actual connecting conversation. And so when you're approaching a conflict or a hard conversation around what did they say, you're looking at it in a very systematic, analytical, and critical way. The goal of a relationship is connection. Is being together, enjoying one another. If you're looking at what they're saying, you're not having that heart posture, that mentality around what do they mean. You're not looking, like we just talked about, you're not looking for that vulnerability. You're not looking to see what that person sees. You're looking for confirming or disconfirming, you know, words based on how you feel, so that way you can negate, you can flip, you can nitpick. And that's, it's just, it's compounding on the conflict. Real conversations happen and get solved by understanding. It's less about the words and more about the meaning, and certainly about the feeling, because that's what matters to us. And so engaging into real meaningful conversations around meaning, clarifying questions. Hey, I don't quite understand. Is this what you meant? Let me repeat what you just said to make sure I get it. All those things protect that goal of connection, and they remove that analytical and critical side of like difficult places. You can have hard conversations that don't have to be distancing or separating. You can actually be more connected to your partner after these talks.
Gotcha. Actually, as you're talking about that, something just popped in my head in terms of dating today. And I think this is a little bit relevant. What do you do when you're trying to communicate something to your partner and they are constantly on the phone, and there is just the you know, you can't, you're trying to talk about something serious and they're either on the phone or, you know, social media, this, that, and the other. How do you handle that? It's not my case, but I do know several people that deal with that. It's pretty detrimental to a relationship. I've done it myself, you know, that my better half is talking to me and I'm on the phone because of, you know, my business and social media, stuff like that. So because I know they're going to have that question. What would you recommend to someone who's trying to have a serious conversation with their, with their spouse, their girlfriend, the boyfriend, and they're not in tune with what's going on because of the phone?
Yeah. So let me ask a clarifying question. Is the issue the phone, or is the issue the conversation? Like what's the focus of that question? Because those are very different things.
How about we do both? Let's okay. start off with the conversation. I know okay. that the phone is probably not, it doesn't sound as relevant, but I think the phone and social media has gotten in the middle of so many relationships. It's you know, all the notifications and people are just so drawn to checking to this that, you know, sometimes you go to a restaurant and you see a couple or even friends, everyone's holding the phone while they're eating. And it's like, where's the conversation?
Okay. So starting with the conversation, the focus is a problematic conversation. I would say the first step is the hard part of owning that your feelings that are causing you distress are your problem. So if you don't feel good for whatever reason, you know, finances, you know, busyness, you're stressed, whatever, and you want to talk about it with your partner, that problem, unfortunately, is still your problem. Perhaps they're zoning out and they're decompressing by being on their phone. If you want to talk about it and you're looking for connection, for help with that, that's on you. And so if you want to have that conversation and they're not engaged, initiating by request, because it's a request, because again, it's your responsibility for your emotions. You have to, you can't assume and be entitled. And I feel like even in any style of relationship, it's really easy to feel a level of entitlement for your partner to be with you. For me, I have the viewpoint of intimacy, and intimacy is always a privilege. And so having that connect point should always be a request, never an entitlement. Of course, I understand in serious relationships, marriages, cohabitating, all that kind of stuff, there's a level of expectation. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this one conversation. In this one conversation, it's good to own it and then simply ask, hey, I don't want to bother you if you're on your phone. You know, something's on my mind. Do you have time? If not now, when? And, you know, have a game plan. Go about it a little bit more of an analytical way where you can, you know, look to see how your needs are getting met. What can you expect? Can you maybe right off the bat, they're not going to help you right now. They're zoning out for 15 minutes and then they have to leave. That has to be okay. They need to retain the same freedom that you give, that you have. And so if you're talking about a difficult conversation, just really setting it up and asking. Again, this is different from, you know, expecting certain things in more serious relationships. If you have someone who's chronically avoiding intimacy, that's a different issue. But as far as the phone being a distraction from the conversation, clarity, simple clarity, you know, understanding that it's yours, you want help with it from your partner, and asking, and then putting a timeline to it. When can you expect help? Maybe it's a hectic week at work, maybe later. I would say if you're talking about the phone in general as a distraction, that gets into a little bit more interesting territory for sure, because I would say that gets into what, like, norms really, and they're obviously in relationships, there's personal norms and then there's relationship norms. Is it one person's norm? Is it both person's norm to be on their phones consistently all the time? And the thing is with norms is obviously that they're consistency that are held. They're regular patterns of behavior. And so is it customary for you to be on your phone when you're with your partner? Like, is it bad? Is it good? I'm not here to say. I don't think any real therapist is going to tell you, you know, if that's good or bad, because that's dependent upon interpretation. But if you really find the phone as a distraction, you know, again, setting aside time or even just vocalizing that you don't like it. I mean, I think a lot of times in relationships, we feel that our partner knows what we think. And even especially the closer you are, like, you know, especially married couples, even, it's like, we live together, how would you not know this? It's like, I've never heard you say it. And we think, oh, don't you see me being frustrated? Don't you see me being frazzled? It's like, no, I didn't, because we're naturally very focused on ourselves. And that's kind of how we reference the world. And so being vulnerable, being open, sharing your opposition, sharing what you're looking for, you know, you want to put the phone away, you want to engage with one another, you know, it's just setting expectations, sharing, and creating a game plan for it.
Fantastic. I think you answered that pretty well. You know, it's so relevant, and that actually is going to tie us up to our next question: vulnerability and boundaries in our relationship. So, you know, one of your posts says, apologies aren't complete without restitution and commitment to protect what was damaged. That should be like posted somewhere on a billboard. You know, we all have expectations that aren't met in relationships, but repeated behaviors need boundaries. not just forgiveness. Once it's repeated, your pain becomes a choice, not an affliction. Now, I think, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, this goes with the best apology is change behavior. You know, I don't know if that goes tied with that, but I love this. I think it's worth repeating. Apologies are not complete without restitution and commitment to protect what was damaged. So why don't you tell us about this, you know, based on your experience, your perspective?
Yes. So it's when something happens, when conflict happens, something's broken, right? And the whole classic example of a kid breaking a lamp or a vase or whatever, it's like, it's very tactically, tangibly broken. When you have relationship conflicts, there's something very tactically, tangibly broken. It's called trust. Like, and we all know what it's like to lose trust with somebody. It's very noticeable. Oh, yeah. And there's ways people apologize and go about fixing that that conflict or that situation that really do nothing to address what was broken. One of the worst is, oh, I'm sorry you feel that way, which is basically saying, like, I did nothing wrong, but I'm sorry you're in distress, which shows no accountability, no remorse, no change behavior, no empathy. It's not helpful.
You know what? I'm sorry to cut you off real quick. I actually, now that you said that, I have seen that in many of the gurus' posts to say, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, you know, so on and so forth. And you just, I loved what you just said. Yeah, I'm so, you know, like, I'm sorry that you feel that way. It's almost like insinuating that it's on me, but you're not taking accountability for what you just did.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And so, again, relationships are about connection. Is what you're doing protecting that connection or not? And when you have a conflict for someone to say, I'm sorry you feel that way, you're validating their experience, but you're also removing yourself from contributing or influencing that experience in any way, which removes any empathy from the conversation. Because that person is saying, yes, hey, this was my experience. This is what I perceive happening. You know, at the very least, if you're looking to protect connection, you on the hearing and the listening end of that conversation should ask, I don't understand. Can you explain it more? You need to be able to see, hear, feel, understand what your this is your partner we're talking about. And even if it's not romantic, even if it's a friendship, it's about empathy, it's about connection. And if you're not doing that, you know, it's you know, I want to call names, but like it's unkind, to say the least.
Exactly.
We're talking about friends and romantic partners here. We want to be kind to the people we care about. And so yeah, absolutely, the best apologies are restitution. It's a commitment. Hey, I'm sorry I'm late. Or no, let me rephrase that. If you're on the giving end, if you're, you know, I'm hurt because you're late, this is the third time, blah, 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 blah. You know, restitution does take ownership. I'm sorry, I was late. You know, I really apologize. I don't want you to feel like you don't matter or that you're, you know, secondhand because of my tardiness. But on top of that, real care, real diligence, is a commitment to not actually do that again. Like, it's not a real apology, or at least you can apologize once, but if the behavior continues, you're showing that you're devaluing the responsibility that you've initially taken with the apology. Repeated offenses really just diminish the empathy. You might say you're empathetic, but your actions are contributing otherwise. And I hear it from women all the time in my DMs, you know, my man did this and he does this. It's like, okay, if he does this, if this is chronic, if this is norm, you're both liable. You're putting up with this behavior. You chose it too. And so you're participating with your own affliction and you're creating that. And so, unfortunately, this is where, you know, hard boundaries have to come into place. It's like, hey, you know, you're late for the third time going to the movies. If it happens again, I'm going to go without you and you're going to need to take your car because I don't like missing previews. And you know, usually it's going to, okay, cool. They're 10 minutes late. And then you leave and you sit in the movie, you watch your popcorn, you enjoy your preview, and they're going to huff and puff and be like, what the hell? And whatever. It's like, hey, I thought we had a clarification that this is what I was looking for. I asked you to help me get that need met and you didn't want to, and I told you I was going to make sure that I did that myself. And it can definitely seem harsh and it can definitely seem combative, but it's taking that ownership over yourself, your desires, what you're looking for, and not compromising yourself for your friendships or relationships.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. You know, your boundaries. And also I wanted to mention something that based on the little bit of reading and research that I've done. You know, I wrote an article. I don't know if you got to see it on Narcopaths, you know, the combination of a narcissist and sociopath. And if you are dealing with a narcissist, they will do things like that. They will not respect your boundaries. They will push your boundaries until to see how far they could go. They have no respect for anything, really. So you also have to pay attention. I think there should be a class starting in elementary school or even high school, teaching people how to spot a narcissist or one of those cluster B personality people. Because if you don't know that you're dealing with one of these type of people, you will not be able, like, it's confusing. It's very confusing to know that they're, you know, they play mind games. Mm-hmm. There is emotional warfare, things like that. So always keep an eye on trying to find out, you know, who you're dealing with, educate yourself, and definitely follow Marcus to learn more about it. All right. So we're going to jump to the next question. Marcus, why don't you tell us about unlearning habits, conditioning, and what it looks like to learn new habits to truly see changes in your life?
Yes. So I recently was reading through a book and looking into this psychology principle. Habits they're so deep. Habits are so powerful because they happen at the unconscious level. What happens is you have a cue, a ritual, and a reward. The cue is, you know, the environmental or the feeling that sets you up to do something, and the reward is obviously the payoff of what you're getting out of it. You know, real habits are very hard to break, and there's really no such thing as an unlearned habit. It's a common saying. I know what people mean, but as far as actually unlearning a habit, habits can't be unlearned because that's actually how deep they go. You have to replace them, because if you leave a habit, and you just try to avoid the cue, the stimulus, at any point that thing can come back, and it might not be as strong, but it's very liable to come back. So you're doing great on the diet, blah blah blah, and you rid yourself of all cupcakes because you're a fiend for cupcakes. You love it, and it's how you usually would manage your stress. Well, what's going to happen is if you're at the grocery store and by chance you feel stressful, you're probably going to grab one of those. And so real habit change is unfortunately trial and error, to be honest. It's not easy, but it is doable. It's looking at, you have to understand what's setting you off, what are you doing about it, and then what's the reward. And any three of those areas, you know, just need to be changed, tweaked, or maneuvered. And so, like I said, if stress is your cue, you can change the ritual or change the reward, you know, or you could change the cue as well. Like and that's the case with boundaries, removing yourself from certain people or environments. But again, that's not always the case if you have some sort of like eating habit or, you know, something like that. And so, yeah, unfortunately, it is just a lot of trying to figure out, and it's not easy, and I would encourage anyone to stay with it, because I know it can feel very futile when you're switching and creating new habits, but they're worth it, because the habits you do create, again, create your norms, your consistencies, and that's the basis and the foundation of who you're going to become. So make sure that your habits, you protect your good habits, and just try to annihilate your bad habits.
Absolutely. Yeah, I actually got a little excerpt from one of your posts that actually I was supposed to read before you said it, because you pretty much said it all, but I think it's important to read it even now. So habits are formed through repetitions, through a cue, ritual, reward cycle, like Marcus just mentioned. A lot of scientific evidence has found that a lot of spontaneous or random decision-making is heavily influenced by unconscious patterns of thought. When it comes to changing our lives and our relationships, this is where the hacking can very practically begin. Habits like eating, television, social media consumption, and even emotional responses to conflict can reveal regularly kept habits in our minds. That's pretty interesting. I like this part. Even emotional responses to conflict can reveal regularly kept habits in our minds. So that's what you were saying, right? Like, just don't change the, replace the habit. Don't, you literally cannot undo
a habit. You cannot unlearn, correct.
Unlearn a habit. Absolutely. Gotcha. All right, guys, you see, this is good stuff right here that we're learning. Now we're going to go to our next question. So let's talk about proximity. How proximity doesn't correlate to intimacy. This is pretty interesting. I don't think I had heard anything like this before. That's why I think, you know, a lot of your posts are fresh air type of thing. Tell me about this.
Yes. And so this, unfortunately, is probably one of the deepest areas of me where I learned this because of where I came from with my family. Again, just feeling more outcast, isolated. Amidst the full home, I had two brothers, both my parents in the same house, but still feeling so isolated. It wasn't, unfortunately, it wasn't something that needed to be taught. It was just my experience growing up. And it's very much in terms, you know, when you look at relationships and especially marriages, and I've come to understand that a lot of what failing relationships and marriages are made of, it's proximity, but not intimacy. And it's unfortunate because I'm sure you probably have heard that many people try to go to therapy on average 6 years too late, you know, when conflicts are needing assistance to be worked out. And then they come into therapy and you have two people sitting down in front of each other who are legally married, but they don't know each other anymore. They don't know the intricacies, the intimate parts, you know, what the other person's thinking, feeling. And again, that vulnerability has been severed for an extended period of time. And so, yeah, real intimacy, real vulnerability is not a matter of proximity of what's around you. It's an intentional act of connection.
That's pretty deep. It is. Well, you know, once you're with someone for a number of years, it, you know, children come into place, you know, the life in general, you know, your stresses from work, from life, from family, you know, ill parents, things like that. It could definitely put a strain on that. So it's definitely important to recognize, you know, the difference. Okay, now let's talk about self-esteem and how we can nourish it. I was reading, I found this little piece that I thought was important. Growth emotionally and in our self-esteem must come from a place of love, understanding, and grace. But it must be equally balanced with accountability and making your decisions binary to know that either you choose to become better or you don't. Tell us about that, Marcus, self-esteem and how we can nourish it.
Yes. And so this is definitely where my competitive man side comes out a little bit, because you look at self-esteem from a psychological perspective, it's literally just your self-evaluation on who you are. It's, do you believe in yourself? Do you trust yourself? Do you see yourself as reliable? Do you have skills that you can use and utilize and, you know, make value from? And so in today's, you know, mental health space, it's like self-esteem and anxiety are becoming so, so commonplace. And people talk about, you know, how do you raise your self-esteem? I struggle with low self-esteem, you know, all these kind of things. And first and foremost, I would ask, are you doing anything to violate yourself? Are you doing anything to compromise who you are? That's going to kill your self-esteem, not even just with another person, but with yourself. Do you say that you're going to do something only to not? Because it's like literally having you next to you. You make that commitment. You say, I'm going to go work out every day, and then you don't. And so, of course, that person next to you that is yourself starts to recognize and think, I can't rely on the words that this person's telling me, just like any relationship. And you have that break and that sever. And so if you want to raise your self-esteem, you need to balance it with accountability. I'm all for grace. I'm all for understanding. I'm all for compassion, all of the beautiful things that make us human. But if you want self-esteem, if you want to feel like a bad mofo, like just want to get after it a little bit, you want to make commitments, you want to do hard things. And you want to do something that you can be proud of. If you don't have anything in your life that you're doing that you're proud of, you're not actively building your self-esteem. And it needs to be somewhat challenging. You need to have that risk to fail. You can have the grace and compassion and understanding when you fail, but going and doing that thing and, you know, call it half the time beating that challenge, you're going to have some self-esteem built, because you're proving to yourself that you are a strong, reliable, skillful person.
As you were saying, you know, the person that is next to you, which is you, it makes total sense. If you are not able to show up for yourself, how are you going to show up for others? And I actually talk about that a lot, and I've been implementing that in my own style. I've always done it on and off, you know, me time, self-care. It's extremely important. It's tied up with everything we do in the holistic arena. When you do self-care and me time, that should be included in this section, you know, setting goals for yourself, you know, because that's part of loving yourself when you do things that make you happy. And I've talked about this with different friends as of recently. It's like you can't show up for others and be fully present when you're not doing that for yourself. If you don't do something for you to show yourself that love. You know, and it's just noticeable. Some people are living this chaotic environment of like going. They don't, and it's almost not fair to people around you. You continue in that fight or flight mode, and not just easier said than done. But I think as humans, we have to, or individuals, it's always part of evolving and growing is learning to do things to better your life yourself. So, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to mention, I loved what you said there when you talked about you can't do it for other people if you're not doing it for yourself. It's true to such a powerful degree where you might be able to do it for some time, but you're looking for that external affirmation that yourself is looking for from you. And we think that if we can get enough external affirmation, if we can get enough of those external evaluations in a good light, that we'll finally feel strong, not recognizing you're becoming more fragile, because whenever you have a bad evaluation, everything plummets. Yeah. You're leaving your, again, that's returning back to that self-concept, that understanding of who you are to chance based on your environment. And we all know the world's looking to kick your ass as soon as it can. So you gotta understand that sometimes you are all you can rely on, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. When you're faced with challenges, when you're faced with obstacles, you believe in yourself is enough. And it sounds cheesy and corny, but it's true.
It is just so true.
You believing in yourself is absolutely enough to persevere. And what's funny is when you actually make it, or even if you don't, your environment will start shifting around you. Others will be like, I didn't even know you can get that far. You know, exactly. I didn't even know you could do that. And that's where it's like, oh, the world, instead of us trying to be recognized by the world starts to actually recognize who we are.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And when you said, you know, I think it's cheesier now, you actually made a very good point. You know, if you don't expect validation from the outside world when everything collapses, you have you. That is something that a lot of us, I think I see it as a new in psychology. The holistic psychologist mentions that, things like that. Like, always we were conditioned to certain things growing up, you know, our families, it has to do with the culture, how you grew up, whatever. But it's so, what you just said is so important. And I want to start closing with that, guys. Always, like Marcus is saying, and myself, you know, take time for you, time, grow, learn, always try to, you know, change, obviously, behaviors. I include myself, because obviously we're not perfect, right? So always trying to grow, educate, read, whatever it is that you have to do to be in a better place, you know, the future journaling, things like that. So very cool. We're pretty much getting close to the end of the podcast. Marcus, is there anything that you wanted to say to our audience in terms of what we've talked about, relationships and things like that in today's dating scene?
Yeah, I would say in closing, so many people in relationships, and again, platonic, romantic, whatever, are looking for something. The more you can figure yourself out, the more you're actually going to find. The more you know yourself, the more secure you'll be. Find your boundaries, your non-negotiables, what you are willing to negotiate on. Get super clear on that, and it's going to set you up for a lot of success, I promise.
Beautifully said. Any books, favorite authors that you could recommend? I forgot to mention that before we close, or anything that comes to mind.
I don't know. Well, again, like I am influenced quite, you know, through my spiritual journey. Like I don't want to push anything for anyone else, but for my journey, I did experience a lot of healing through the Christian faith. And so for me, I read a book called Boundaries. If you're not spiritual, the first half may still be helpful. It's just very, very clear on, you know, how to actually draw, or even goes into depth, how boundaries are created, how they're formed, mm-hmm. how they're misaligned, and how to correct them. And that was probably one of the top five books that brought me a ton of healing. So I think, again, in the idea of self-concept clarity and boundaries and knowing yourself, the Boundaries book by James Townsend and Henry Cloud would be a good place to start.
Perfect. All right, guys, you heard it from Marcus. That's one of the good books. There's also other books that I come to mind that I could potentially put in the show notes. But all right, this basically concludes our podcast. But I wanted to remind you, don't forget to visit, interact, and tell Marcus that you learned about him via the podcast. You could follow him on Instagram at TheRealistTherapist. Also, Marcus' website is in the works, but you can go ahead and subscribe to his newsletter in the meantime, so you learn, you know, when the website launches, which is going to be fantastic. And the URL is therealisttherapist.com. Marcus, it's been an absolute pleasure having you. I love your wisdom. You're going to go places, not like you aren't already. And hopefully I could have you on the podcast again.
Thank you so much. For anyone who's listening, please hit me up. I will respond to every comment and DM. Thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it.
Awesome. Looking forward to having you again.